That was a little much. The bar is high now. I don't expect anything. I did pray, though, so if you get what you need, it ain't my fault. My name is Robert, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be here, and I'm grateful to be sober today. And one of the main reasons that I'm grateful to be here is because in this room, at this conference, 12 years ago, was the time I went to my first conference. You know, the Georgia Prepaid, the last time it was in Savannah, was the first conference that I ever went to. And it was amazing to me, right? Because when you get sober, you see the people around you, right? And you kind of think that, like, that's the sum total of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's like, oh, it's just these people, right? And then you go to something like a statewide convention or the international convention, and your mind is blown by the size and scope of the effect that Alcoholics Anonymous has had. You know, we got the international convention coming up. I hope to see all y'all there. My first home group was Savannah Group. It meets on Monday and Thursdays at 8. So I know some of y'all are missing your home group. And I think you get demerits for that there. You might have to give up a year of sobriety or something. But yeah, I'm grateful to be here because when I came to this conference, a bunch of just magical stuff happened for me. I fell in love with speaker tapes. I love hearing people's stories. I absolutely love it. I don't have any beef with discussion meetings. I don't think they're bad, but I just love it when somebody will tell their story. And you know, because I love it, you know, sometimes I guess that means it's my turn. And I came to this and I heard this lady share. She had been sober a really long time. She used to drink with Billie Holiday. She used to get messed up with Billie Holiday. And I dig jazz. I was like, I want to talk to this lady, right? And, you know, I didn't see her for a couple days, but I'm standing outside smoking. I think I was like a greeter or something. I had some job they'll trust somebody with 9 months to do, you know? And I'm standing outside and somebody I don't know walks up to me and hands me a little folder, you know, a little envelope. He's like, "Hey man, I can't go to the Low Country Boil. Do you want to go?" And I was like, okay. And I took the tickets and I went and I got my plate and I sat down and I started eating and I look up and the lady who just sat down was the lady who used to get drunk with Billie Holiday. And so just magically I got to pick this lady's brain about, you know, what it's like to get drunk in the jazz age. Which I didn't ever think would happen. You know, it really feels like it's full circle for me because this is where I got sober and we've moved a lot. And, you know, when you move, the other people, they try real hard. You know, when you move to a new town, they try to do, they just don't do it quite right. You know, like wherever you got sober is the place where it's like, yeah, those people know how to AA, you know? And so I come here and I was telling Denny before the meeting, I didn't realize like how many amazing people I got to know in a very short time in this town. Right, this town is filled with amazing people who will bend over backwards to help someone get sober. And that's the deal, right? Like, that's the deal. If we get given this gift, then we have to give it to somebody else. You know, one of the first questions my sponsor asked me is, if you get this, will you give it to somebody else? You know, and I know there are people here who do that. Now, I said I'm an alcoholic. That means something fairly specific to me. It means that I fit the description of alcoholism in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It comprises a few things, right? I have something strange with my body. We talk about it right at the beginning, and the doctor's, he ain't even alcoholic. I don't know why we listen to him, right? But we talk about it in the doctor's opinion, right? This physical craving that comes on. I have a physical reaction to alcohol that is abnormal to other people's reaction to alcohol. I know that my reaction is abnormal because they take a few drinks and they do weird stuff like, no, I'm starting to feel it. Right? And I have a few drinks and I am starting to feel it. And I got to drink everything that's there. It's been that way ever since I started drinking. Right? There's never been, I know people progress from being a social drinker into being an alcoholic. I know they do because they tell me they do. That's just not my experience. I'm freeze-dried alcoholic. Right? When there was enough alcohol around for me to drink, I drank like I would drink from then on. It started that night. You know, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I'm not here to tell you I hate alcohol. Alcohol did something for me. I need it done. Right? I mean, I could have used a martini early on. You know, maybe kindergarten-ish. I mean, so I got that problem. I got the problem in my body. And if the problem is just in my body, then the solution to that is don't pour any liquor down your neck. Right? Don't put any alcohol in. I won't have the abnormal reaction. I won't drink everything that's there, and I won't do the crazy things that I do. Right? So the second part of the problem that I have is I have a mind that tricks me back into taking the first drink. And it does it a whole bunch of different ways. Right? It looks like, I can get away with it. They're not gonna give me a urinalysis tomorrow. You know? Like, it'll be fine. I won't mess up this relationship. Right? I can get away with it. Or just forget it. Who cares? Right? It always gets me to take the first one again, setting the cycle in motion, which brings me pain and suffering. Me and those around me. And I was really scared when I started reading in the big book with my sponsor, and we got to there as a solution. Because it said the only solution that we have to offer is a spiritual solution. And I was like, I'm going to die. This is really bad. And that's what it means for me to be alcoholic. I have those two things and I have a spiritual malady, which really is just kind of the human condition. Selfishness, self-centeredness, prey to misery and depression, can't control my emotional natures, can't seem to make a real living, can't seem to be of real use to anyone else. I suffer from that sober, right? Liquor fixed that. Thank God for liquor, right? You know, I grew up feeling kind of different. My parents moved around a lot when I was little. They were, you know, out there trying to do stuff like be helpful to people and all that weirdness. And so we moved a lot. And I remember when I started to feel different, we had just moved to a new town. And I used to be the fastest kid in the class at my old school. And I go to this new town and I simultaneously get glasses and this big mouthpiece, right? This thing that's going to straighten my teeth. And it is hilarious. And so I'm different now. I'm not fast anymore. I have the glasses. I got the mouth thing. And I feel different. I feel like I don't fit in. I feel like people are judging me. I feel disconnected, right? That's what I really have. I have a disease of disconnection, right? I feel disconnected from everybody around me. And that didn't go away until I found alcohol. The first time I drank anything, I was 10. And my uncle's a cool dude. And I'd seen him drinking beer. And I was like, hey, can I have one of those? And he said, sure. And he gave me a beer, and I cracked it open, and took a drink, and I was like, why would anybody drink that? That's terrible. I think it was like Natty Ice or something. You know, something real classy. And the second time I drank, I was 13, and me and a buddy had stolen gin from his parents' bar. And he had stolen, it was like in a Tupperware, like squeeze bottle thing. And he drank first, right? He just drank some and handed it to me. And I mean, then I had to drink it because Ashley had already drank it. Now I have to, right? And so I drink it and it burns. And I'm like, why would anybody do that? But I wanted to be cool, so I kept drinking. And we found out, like, if you pour gin, there's this little stump. If you pour gin on it, strike a lighter to it, it burns blue, right? For just a second, it'll burn blue. And so we keep drinking and burn a little bit of it. And we were smoking rolled up lawn clippings. I used to say grass, but people would get confused. This is lawn clippings. And drinking this gin. And by the time we ran out, I remember thinking, man, we shouldn't have burned any of that. You know, we spent the rest of the night singing along to oldies. It was before like a school trip or something. We spent the rest of the night singing along to oldies. Everything was great. Everything was magical. You know, here I'm with my best friend, feeling great for the first time in forever. And then the next time I drank, I was 15, and I drank like I would drink from then on. I'm real macho. So it was Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill. I know y'all drank it. Don't be judging. And sangria, right? Both of which are easier to drink than straight gin, right? And I drank everything that was there. I drank all of it. That's the way I do it, right? I drank everything that was there, and I blacked out, passed out, threw up, woke up on a dock in a neighborhood where a lot of my parents' friends lived. So like woke up in trouble, right? And I knew I was going to do it again as soon as I possibly could. Because at some point in that night, alcohol had addressed my spiritual malady. The ninth step promises came true. I was cool enough. I was smart enough. I was comfortable in my skin. If there were girls there, I could have talked to them. For the first time, I was free. I had made a monumental scientific discovery about how to live life. Right? And so I chased it. I mean, who wouldn't? You'd be crazy not to if you find something that does that for you. If it's still doing it for you, I don't know, man, run that thing into the ground. You know, because that's the big problem, is that I got to a point where I couldn't get that anymore. Where everything that it did for me was gone. And in very slow motion, it took everything that I ever cared about. Right? And I chased it. I drank every opportunity that I could, which in a small town in middle Georgia is sometimes hard to do. It all depends on whose older brother is home, right? But I drank every opportunity I could. It influenced every decision I made. I'd had pretty good grades. They started to slip. Used to be involved in a bunch of stuff in school. Started to stop doing that. Started to stop. That's a weird phrase. When it came time to choose schools, I was either going to go to this school in New York or this school in New Orleans. Either way, it was going to be new, and I was going to be out of my small town, because that's the problem, right? That's why I feel that way. It's because of the town. It's the town's fault, right? And I went to visit the school in New Orleans. I didn't even need to visit the school in New York, because during the tour — this is a really great sales point for this university — during the tour, they were like, well, you know, the state of Louisiana is a little bit different from the other states. They don't accept federal funding, so that we can have some of our rules be a little bit different. So at the age of 18, you can drink inside your private residence legally. And dorm rooms are considered residences. And I was like, Mom, Dad, their architecture program is amazing. This is the school for me. And my poor parents bought my nonsense and sent me to this school. And I went to class a couple times. Not that much. I got a fake ID within the first couple days of being there. I had signed up for 8 a.m. classes like a fool. I didn't make it. I didn't make it. And, you know, I mean, the first semester, I got them to say that I was having psychological issues and give me a withdrawal failure. I mean, it's true. And then by the second semester, they were like, I'm sorry, we don't want you to go to this university anymore. You're kind of dragging down our averages. That's not great. And so they politely asked me to leave the university. I would do all kinds of weird stuff. I was a little younger. I was only 17. And like I said, you only had to be 18 to drink inside your dorm room, right? So all I have to do is like, oh, I don't know, not get caught for a month. And I couldn't do it. I got really drunk, and I punched this glass box with the RA's names in it, and they followed the blood trail back to my dorm room, and they brought me to the hospital, and I was assigned my first substance abuse counselor, right? You know, happy 18th birthday. And I go to this substance abuse counselor, and I know what's happening. You know, my granddad had a little drinky poo problem, and I know you don't need to tell him the whole truth on those forms. So they give me the form, and I, you know, omit some things, and I give it to the guy. The guy looks at it, and he's like, oh, looks like you're an alcoholic. And I'm like, I didn't even tell him everything. You know? And I got off that, and I mean, I got out of having to do a lot of this stuff, because the next semester, they just asked me to leave. And I decided to live in New Orleans and live on my own, like an adult. Yeah, I didn't do that real well. And so, you know, a few months after the school has asked me to leave, I get my first arrest. Now, I want to be clear, you don't have to have any of this drama that surrounds my drinking to be alcoholic. Alcoholism is related to what happens when I put it in my body and why can't I stop putting it in my body, right? So if you haven't been arrested, cool. You don't need to be arrested to be alcoholic. I have been arrested many times. And so this was the first time that I got arrested. And, you know, the real kicker, it was for pot, right? And I go to this diversion program, and it's very it's intense, right? They're going to take a hair sample at the beginning and a hair sample at the end, and random urinalysis 7 days a week. Who knows when they're going to call? And I got to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I had to get this little sheet signed. I went to 14 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to go 15 times. I went to 14 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I lost my sheet. And I went to my diversion counselor lady. And I was like, hey, you know, you saw it last week when it had 14. Do I just need to do one more? She's like, oh, no, here's a new sheet. And so I went to 15 more meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been to 29, the sum total, 29 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I've gone to. And I will tell you what I remember. One dude sold his front door. That's what I remember. I remember that because I remember thinking, wait, how much do you have to sell to get to the front door? Right? That's the door that guards all of your stuff. Right? So I've never sold a front door. I'm not alcoholic. Right? And, you know, I'm sure there were people there carrying a message. I'm sure there were people there talking about what alcoholism is and really looks like. I just couldn't hear anything. All I could hear was, dude sold his front door. And I'd love to tell you I stayed sober for those 5 months. I didn't. I just did stuff you can't test for. You know, 5 months of like, you'll go to jail, right? I have these consequences hanging over my head, right? And I still can't stay sober. I drank at least 3 times and I did a bunch of other stuff. I just didn't get caught. And it would start a theme. I mean, that was kind of the theme of my drinking years, was constantly on probation, never getting off on time. You know, because they extend it if you don't do the things they want. Except this last time, I got off early. But yeah, so I lived in New Orleans and I'd been to AA. And I was seeing this young lady and she decided to move to Athens, Georgia. I think she was probably trying to get away from me, which was a good call. Because, I mean, who wants to be with somebody who's getting dumber, drunker, crazier, poorer, right? It's not really an upward trend on the life track, you know? But I followed her, you know. And I moved to Athens, and I thought, you know, this is going to fix it, right? Like, if I move to Athens, things will be different. It's not New Orleans. New Orleans is crazy. It's New Orleans' fault. And I moved to Athens. I don't know if y'all know, University of Georgia's in Athens. And there might be one or two people who drink a little bit there. I happen to find those people wherever I go, right? And, you know, I found them and I did it like I did it. And within a few months, that young lady was like, I'm sorry, I just can't want you to do this to yourself anymore. Which was also a theme of my drinking, which people that I care about tell me they can't watch me do this to myself anymore. And, you know, I took 2 weeks off work to mourn the loss of that relationship. And drink every day, right? So when we talk about the physical phenomenon of craving and the danger that it puts me in, this is when I have a lot of really good examples for that, right? Because I would do things like, I was delivering pizza, and I would do things like have a couple beers to take the edge off. It's a long shift, right? And by the end of it, I've drank the whole 24-pack, and I don't remember, and I went home with their money, right? They frown on that. They don't like it when you don't return with their money, or at least the food, right? So I would deliver shifts blacked out. I woke up from a blackout on the top of a 6-story construction site that I wasn't working on, right? Like, those things, the things that happen once the phenomenon of craving starts, are the things that will kill me. The example that I've heard that I like the best is the physical phenomenon of craving is the bullet in the gun when you're playing Russian roulette. Right? One of the time, right? And the finger on the trigger is the mental obsession. This time I can get away with it. I won't do the same things. Right? And so every time that thought wins, I'm pulling the trigger. And one day, because of the phenomenon of craving, the bullet will be in the chamber. That's what ensures that I will die from alcoholism. Right? It's guaranteed to me. That was true at 16. Age does not matter. Alcoholism does not care, you know, and I did things like that. And I had a really bad experience this one time. I was trying to keep this poor young lady. She asked me to calm it down. And so on my 22nd birthday, worst thing that can happen to an alcoholic happened to me. It's just the worst. I went out and I just had 2 beers on my birthday. I was so proud of myself. Right. And I thought, that means, see, look, I can control it. Right? Within a few months, she was gone. It was over. I was drinking all the time. I started this thing. I switched jobs because it's the job's fault, right? You know, so I got a new job. And I didn't have a place to stay anymore because my roommate had asked me to leave. Because I would do things like yell at him. I remember this one time. I come out of my room. I kept Golden Grain in the freezer. Golden Grain, Everclear, whatever, grain alcohol in the freezer. It's about 180, 190 proof. It says on the bottle, this will make you go blind, right? But, you know, on a shaky morning, put it in a little Dr. Pepper, it'll calm things down, right? And I wake up and it's one of those mornings and I need that, right? And I go in and I open the freezer and the bottle's not there and I am furious. And I walk out and I'm like, Blake, I cannot believe you drank my Golden Grain. You just started laughing at me. He's like, no. You drank it. Why don't you go look in the mirror? And I went and I looked in the mirror and I had apparently thrown up so hard that I had burst all the blood vessels around my eyes. And I looked like a raccoon, you know. And shortly thereafter, he asked me to leave. And it started a new phase of my drinking. I would pay a group of friends $50, $100 a month, whatever, to let me stay on their couch. Right? And I called it couch surfing. That's what I'd heard it referred to as. I thought, you know, it's in a couple movies. I thought it's fine. And I didn't know until I got sober, but like, if you ain't paying rent somewhere, you're homeless. Right? So I was homeless. And I was going through these groups of friends. I was going through them pretty fast, you know, because once I drink, I do embarrassing things and they ask me to leave. And so it gets to the point where I've run out of friends and my car that I use to deliver food is broken down behind the place I work because I can't spend money on tires. You know, I have other things. I got to pay the bar tab, right? Sometimes I would just get my paycheck and walk to the bar and just sign it over to the people who gave it to me. It's hard to keep a car fixed if you do that. And so my car's broken down out back and I've run out of friends, so I start sleeping in my car. This really, I mean, that should tip you off that you're homeless, right? And I'm in this one particularly bad whiskey night. I wake up and it's hot. I don't know if y'all know, Athens in the summer is not cool. It's pretty warm. And I wake up and I'm sweating and it's one of those whiskey sweats where you can just smell the whiskey. And I wake up and I go in and I was supposed to be in at 9 and I was coming in at 10:30 or 11. Which, I mean, that's pretty pathetic, right? I'm sleeping behind the place I work and I can't make it in on time. It's literally like a 50-yard walk. And I go in and I go to clock in and my manager is on the grill doing my job. And he said, you know what, man, don't even bother. And this is how sick the mind is. My immediate reaction is, yes, I don't have to work today. Right? And I go outside and I start smoking and I realize, uh-oh, I don't have a place to stay. I don't have any money and I don't have a job. This is bad. And I got scared and I asked my parents to take me in and I'll forever be grateful that my parents did take me back in, you know. I don't know if they were enablers or not. I just know that they loved me and they didn't want to see me living in my car. And they took me back in and I moved to Savannah, Georgia. And I really thought it's going to be different. I really did. I was like, I'm going to get a straight job, right? I'm going to get a 9-to-5 job. This food service industry is what's killing me, right? If I just get a normal person job, then I'll be okay. So I got a 9-to-5 job, and within a couple months, I got my second DUI. And as I drink, wherever I drink, the way that I drink, every time. So it doesn't matter where I go. It doesn't matter where I work. I do the same things over and over and over again. And I'll tell you a little bit about that night. The best way I've heard this memory problem described is like getting postcards or a brownout, right? Like I just remember little snippets of that night, okay? And what I remember is I'm at the bar drinking with my cousin. Everything's cool. We're having fun, right? And then the next thing I remember is I'm angry because I think the bartender had a boyfriend or something, which... whatever. I don't know. I was real mad about it. And the next thing I remember is I'm driving my car and I'm yelling at a God that I don't believe in. You, I don't believe in you. I'm coming to meet you. which makes no logical sense, right? I don't believe you exist, but I'll be to your house directly, right? And I closed my eyes and I hit the gas. And I hit a tree, and thank God I hit a tree because there was a house behind a tree where probably some poor family was sleeping. And I hit the tree, and the next thing, I don't remember that, but the next thing I remember is I'm out of the car and there are policemen standing around and they're laughing. I don't know why. And I said, you know, if I run, will you shoot me? And they said, no, we'll just beat the crap out of you. And I was like, that's not really what I'm going for. Next thing I remember is I'm in the holding cell, which is not unfamiliar to me, and it's a concrete wall, and my eyes are closed, and I'm just kind of tapping my head against the concrete wall. And I just keep thinking, like, again? God, come on, again? And I open my eyes, and I look down, and my favorite Bob Marley shirt is just covered in blood from the airbag. And I look up, and the rest of the people who are in the holding cell are hugged up against the far wall, so I'm freaking all the other cons out. And the next thing I remember, I'm on the phone with my mom yelling at her to come get me. Come get me now. Like, don't you understand? I'm in jail. Come get me now. Because that's the way that I treat the people I love. Or say that I love. Mom came and got me. And I crawled into the back of her minivan. And something in me broke. And I just started to cry. And I thought, I got to go on probation again. I know I'm not going to get off of it on time. I'm probably going to have to do some real time. And I drank that night. I would love to tell you that that was the last drink I ever took. I would. Because that would mean I'm non-alcoholic. If a heavy drinker given a sufficient reason can stop or moderate, right? Ill health, falling in love, trying to kill yourself, right? They will stop or moderate. I drank that night. I did what alcoholics do. I put off the court date for as long as I could so that I could have one more fun time. And I never got it. Alcohol had stopped doing what alcohol used to do for me. I had stopped being able to get to a point where I felt okay. I would either just blow right past it, or I couldn't get there, and I would stay awake all night drinking until it was time for me to go to work, and I never got to the place where alcohol made me feel okay. And what do you do when your only solution stops working? Right? I didn't seek help. I just put the court date off, and I went to court. And I had a real good lawyer. He walked up to the judge and said, I'd look like a bad lawyer if I couldn't get my client the same deal that that guy got. The judge was like, okay. Right? And so I got this other probation, this new probation, and I made the decision, I'm done. I'm going to be a good boy, right? And I went to my weekend in jail, which they were kind enough to give me, right? They could have given me straight time and I'd have lost my job, but they gave me weekends in jail, and I went to my first weekend in jail. I didn't drink. We got 2 days. And I get out and I white knuckle it through a week of work, and I got 7 days. And I go back in for my second weekend in jail. I get 2 more days. I'm now at 9 days sober. There is no alcohol coursing through my body, right? 9 days sober. And I'm not planning on drinking. I know that my first meeting with my brand new probation officer is the next day. For non-probation people, that means you're going to do your analysis every time, right? So I know that that's coming. But my boss is having a few people over to his house to watch the Super Bowl. I'm like, well, I don't want to be rude, right? So I need to go over to my supervisor's house. I go over to my supervisor's house, and this man, I still don't understand it. He had 6 beers for 3 people. To me, that just makes him a bad host, right? And I'm still not planning on drinking. We're a quarter in, right? We're a quarter into the Super Bowl. I'm not going to drink. That'd be crazy. And something shows up. Something happens to me. Our book calls it a peculiar mental twist or a strange mental blank spot. And that's what happened to me. Next thing I know, I've already had my 2. And one of each of theirs. Right? And it's halftime and I'm like, Chad, we have got to get to the bar. Right? And he takes me to the bar and I drink till they turn the lights on. Because that's how I drink. Right? I drink until they turn the lights on. And I remember going home and being furious. Brand new, fresh probation with a probation officer I hadn't even met yet. And I already know I'm going to fail the first test, right? And I don't know why, but for whatever reason, that is the last time I've had to drink alcohol. I can assure you, I did not earn sobriety. For whatever reason, that was the last time. And I go to a meeting the next day because it's part of my probation. And there's this lady there. And she says she hadn't seen me there before. And, you know, what am I doing there? It's like, well, you know, I was sober for like a year and a half when I lived in New Orleans. And, you know, I just felt like it was a good time. I don't know why I had to lie to her. I just felt it's a good time to come back, you know. It's just, it's convenient. And I go into the meeting, and it's over on the south side, and I go into the south side meeting, and they ask if anyone's new, and like an idiot, I raise my hand and said that I was new, you know. And they start having a first step meeting for me, and see, I'm real quick, so I caught on to what was happening. It was going around the circle, and it was coming my way. And so all I thought about was, what am I going to say? I have to talk. Oh, God. Right. And I said, and it got to me. I didn't hear anything y'all said because I was busy thinking about what I was going to say. Right. And I said, my name is Robert and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm scared to death that this won't work. And I'd love to tell you that right then I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. And that's not what happened. I would keep going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, because they were required. And two, because it was pretty safe, right? Like, I'd never poured any liquor down my neck at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, like, that's a pretty safe place to be. So I would go to meetings, and I would pray to this God that I didn't believe in, please in the morning and thank you at night. And so I'm going to meetings, lots of them. I'm not improving. I'm getting worse. Because I'm just sitting there, and The sober for a long time and happy people infuriated me. I could not stand it. That's one of them right there. You know what I mean? Like, y'all would be talking about things like, one thing I love about Alcoholics Anonymous is I can say I tried to kill myself while I was drunk and half the room is going to smile and nod, right? Normal people would be like, well, get on. You need help, sir. You know? Here, we're like, I've been there. Yeah. It was bad. And then they'll make a joke about it, right? And so I couldn't stand it. I couldn't stand it because y'all would talk about things that I was still ashamed of and afraid anybody would know. And y'all would talk about them and then laugh. I hated the laughers. Because it's like, man, this hurts. Like, it physically hurts me. And so I was intervened upon. And what happened is this lady, and I would go to the first step meeting at Easy Does It every Monday, Saturday, or Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I would go sit in the first step meeting because that was the place where people talked about stuff I could identify with. When people talked about recovery, I did not understand because I had like no reference point. Like, happy, joyous, and free, I haven't ever felt any of that, right? Except for liquor. Right. So I didn't understand any of that. But what I understood was people talking about what their drinking looked like and this strange phenomenon of craving and the mental obsession. I got it. That made sense to me. And what happened was this one lady shared this one night that the obsession to drink had been removed from her. And I was like, no, that's a lie. There's no way. Ever since I drank, I've been obsessed with drinking. Right? I've always thought about drinking. And she's sitting here saying, point blank, she does not think about drinking. Although I thought it was impossible, we'd already started doing a little praying. And so I started adding, please remove the obsession to drink, to my prayers that I didn't believe in, to the God I didn't believe in. See, here's the thing about spiritual actions. You don't even have to believe they'll work. You don't. I didn't. They work great. Right? And so I added that prayer, and my higher power is smarter than me, and he knows that if you just removed the obsession to drink, I probably would have bounced, right? And that is not what happened. So what happened is a week later at that same meeting, all of a sudden I had this thought. If I don't do the things that these people did to be happy about being sober, I will drink again whether I want to or not, and I'll die. And I just knew it was true. You know? I mean, That's not something that you can explain to people. It's something that you either have to realize for yourself or you just don't. And the day that I realized that was the day I was scared enough to ask somebody to sponsor me. And I went to this guy, Steve, man, and I love Steve. I hope he's here. But he's had trouble staying sober, but it didn't matter because that night he was in Alcoholics Anonymous doing his job. He was helping the new man who's afraid and doesn't know what to do. And he was there for me that night, and I said, Steve, man, I know I need a sponsor. I don't know who to ask. And he said, well, not me. Which is the appropriate response if you haven't worked the steps. And he did that. He said, not me. Right? That's the kind thing to do to somebody like me. He said, how about that guy over there? And he pointed at this guy that I'd seen who looked happy, who seemed pretty self-assured and confident, and he could drive a motor vehicle. And, I got all scared. I was like, what if he says no? And Steve was like, it doesn't matter, man. You'll ask somebody else. Just go ask him. And I went and asked him. And he said, yeah. And his face lit up. And he brought me around to the side of the building. And he's like, hey, man, I got to ask you a couple questions. He said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And those lengths are the 12 steps. And I didn't know if I was willing to do that. But I knew the answer he wanted was yes. So I told him yes. And then he asked, if I got it, would I give it to somebody else? And again, I didn't know if I was willing to do that, but I knew the answer he wanted was yes, and I told him yes. And we started meeting before what would become my home group. We met an hour each week, and we read through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was able to explain to me the things that I had never understood, right? I know my drinking's different, right? I've kind of always known that. People have been telling me for a while, right, that my drinking is not like theirs, and I can see it. But I didn't know about there being something wrong with my body that makes it, like, almost impossible for me to stop once I start. I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know. Until I looked back at my experience, I would have told you that every time I drank, I decided to drink. And then I looked back at my experience, and I'm like, well, then you're the worst decision maker ever. It's either you are the worst decision maker ever, or you're powerless over the first drink. And that's terrifying. Right? And so... so we kept reading through the book, and it talked about this came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And it was really simple for me because I wasn't really asked to decide what this higher power was. I just had to have some hope. And my sponsor had told me his story, and I believed that he was like me. I believed that he couldn't quit even when he wanted to. But he hadn't had to drink in 9 years. And so I believed that whatever worked for him could possibly, in theory, work for me. And that was enough. And when we got to the third step, I had expressed my prejudices against religion. Because I had them. And, we read through all the stuff. And what was most important to me about that was this idea that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my problem. Right? Like, at this point... anyone other than me running my life is a good deal. Anybody. Anything. Anybody who's making better decisions than me should manage my life. Right? Because we read that stuff. We read it, selfishness, self-centeredness, that being the root of our troubles, and this spiritual malady, restless, irritable, discontent, prey to misery and depression, can't control my emotional natures, right? And I could identify with all of that. Right. And then we started talking about how I was causing it. And I was like, OK, yeah, I could use a new manager. Sure. Yeah. Sure. Whatever you're using, it's fine. It'll work, you know. And the question that he asked me, and I'll always remember this question, is, are you willing to go through with the rest of the steps and experiment with prayer? And I was like, yeah, if that's what you did, sure. And then he told me how to do the fourth step and sent me on my way and gave me 2 weeks. And it had been 13 days, and I had not written anything. I know, right? And so I decided I would experiment with prayer. And I wish I could tell you I said a nice, kind, sweet, sincere prayer. That's not what I did. I was like, all right, God, a little help down here. Such an ass. And he did anyway. I sat down between the end of the 5:30 meeting, so I sat down in between 6:30 and 8 o'clock, and I wrote down everybody I was angry at, why I was mad at them, how it affected me. I didn't write down the fourth column yet. I don't think I could have gotten there. I wrote down everything that I was afraid of, and I answered the questions about my sex conduct. First time I asked for help, stupid and insincere, and I got it anyway. And so the next day I went to my sponsor's house and we started reading through this inventory. And, you know, the day before that, I would have told you I was a pretty selfless guy. Really. I thought I cared about my friends and family and that I would sacrifice for them. I mean, we lie to ourselves a lot. And what I realized in doing that inventory was I had never given anybody anything unless I thought I was getting something back. Ever. I was afraid. I was inconsiderate. I didn't care about what was going on with you. It was all about so I could talk about me. Right? And I let some people feel a weight lifted. You know, they're like, oh, I just did my fifth step. And I was like, oh, I just did my fifth step. And I gotten a real good look at exactly who I was for the first time. Right? And I didn't want to be that dude anymore. And, you know, I was talking with a friend about it. And how I felt bad after my fifth step, and that seems to not be the same as other people. And she said, oh, honey, that's just God making you willing to be different. That's the sixth step. Magic. Great. You know? Like, that's what happened for me. The sixth step happened to me when I did my fifth step. And I went home and said the prayer, and I truly wanted to be different. And this may not be a big deal for anybody else. We all, you know, tend to burn one character or two character defects down the wick on both ends, just do it to death, right? And mine was anger. I was angry all the time about everything. Like a constant low boil, right, with explosions here and there. And since I asked for that character defect to be removed, I haven't been angry enough to yell at, kick, or hit another human being. And that's not a big deal for a lot of people, because they can just do that. But for me, that's a big deal. Right. And I started to become different. So I'll tell you the moment that Alcoholics Anonymous took ownership of me. I was just down over there installing some cabinets in the middle of summer with no air conditioning. It was real hot and I was sweating. And all of a sudden a thought pops into my head, man, a cold beer would be nice. That's the truth. It's not even a lie trying to get me to take the first drink this time, right? A cold beverage of any variety would be refreshing. And I freaked out, and I called Danny. And I was like, I just had the thought a cold beer would be nice. And he's like, okay, well, I'm at work. You know, you recoil from it as from a hot flame. That's a 10th step promise, and you're not even on the 10th step. So, I mean, you should be grateful. Call me when you get off work. And I hung up the phone and I realized that was the first time I hadn't thought about the first time I'd thought about alcohol in 2 weeks. And I was yours. I was like, what are we doing? We're making amends? Fine. Great. Let's do it. What are we doing? We're doing service work? Okay. I got to stand up here and tell my fine. I'll do it. Because previous to that, I had not experienced any amount of time where I wasn't thinking about alcohol. Maybe a couple hours at the most, right? Here it was, 2 weeks, and I hadn't even thought about alcohol. So I'm here to tell you the same thing that lady told me in the meeting. The obsession to drink has been removed from me. I very rarely think about a drink, and when I do think about a drink, the reaction is very different. Right? My old reaction is, don't tell anybody, don't say anything. It worms its way inside my head, and it wins. The last time I thought about a drink, the immediate thought that followed was, that's stupid. That's a very different reaction, right? We talk about a psychic change, right? And a psychic change is just a change of the mind, right? And so something, while I wasn't paying attention, went into my mind and changed it. And I was like, okay, there might be a God type thing. Sure. All right. I might pray a little bit more now. And, you know, and I started having to pray because I started having to make amends. And we started off with some softballs. We started off with my parents. And I went to them and I said, you know, I've been a bad son. I haven't been a member of this family. I haven't contributed. I've taken away your right to be my parents by never listening to your advice or asking you for advice. And I know that was wrong, and I'd like to do whatever I can to make it up to you. And both of them said the same thing. We just want you to be happy. Right? So the amends aren't the talk. Right? The talk is what tells me what I need to do for the amends. So how I make amends to my parents is I routinely show up where they are and let them know that I'm happy. Right? That's why I'm staying down here a few extra days, because my parents live here and I'm going to go where they are and I'm going to be happy around them. Because I can do that today. Right? There are people in here laughing. If you're new, you probably haven't felt that way in a long time. And that is a painful way to live. I know it because I lived that way, and it was dreadful. Maybe I laughed, maybe I smiled. There was no joy. You know? It was all just some... I was probably just trying to make y'all think I was happy. Right? Actually, I was thinking about killing myself when I was 13. Thank God for liquor staving that off. I mean, that's another great promise. I haven't thought about killing myself in over a decade. Like, that's... Oh, yeah. My sobriety date is February 6th of 2007. So it's been a little over 12 years since I've had to drink. Which is impossible. Right? Like, the best I did on my own was 9 days and 4 of them were in jail. And it's been 12. And it's funny because they're actually both here tonight. But I got pretty happy around the ninth step. Right? I got pretty happy. And I remember these two old timers. They had way more time than me. And they both said, "Oh, I can't wait for you to fall off your pink cloud, buddy." And I got scared. I did. I thought that meant that at some point I was just going to start feeling like that again. And I couldn't go back there. And I got scared and I asked my sponsor and he said, "Well, I think it was Dr. Bob who said that, if he keeps doing the same things he's been doing, there's no reason to expect different results." Right? And that to me is what makes the program of Alcoholics Anonymous math. Right? It's because in math, you do the same things every time, you get the same answer. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, if we do the same things every time, we get the same answer. That's been my experience. If I suffer, it's on me. Y'all already told me what to do. You know? Doesn't mean bad things won't happen. It doesn't mean people that I love won't die. It means that I will have to go back to restless, irritable, and discontent if I don't do the things that y'all do. Because I've seen y'all make it through everything. I mean, we're in double digits of people that I've watched walk to their death knowing they were going to die with dignity and respect, helping people. That's power, right? If my problem is I don't have enough power, I must get connected to the thing that y'all are connected to. And we've watched it over and over again. I was just talking about it at dinner tonight. One of the first people I ever heard tell their story was Cancer Mike. Y'all know why they called him Cancer Mike. And he got up there. I'm 3 months sober. He got up there at 12 years sober or something crazy like that, right? And he's talking about how he has cancer. It's terminal. He knows he's going to die. But he's happy for every day he gets so he can try and help somebody else. The next week, our friend Donald comes up and his mom's just died. And he's telling his story. And he's talking about how grateful he is that he can be there to be helpful when his mom passed. And I'm blown away, right? Because I drink for no reason. And these guys are going through some of the worst stuff. And they don't have to drink. That's power, right? Like, that's what y'all show me. Right? When we talk about sharing experience, strength, and hope, the experience is mine. I was there for it, right? The strength and the hope, we just pass around to whoever needs it that day, and we don't even know who it is. How magical is that? It's impossible. How many times have y'all walked into a meeting feeling not so great, and somebody immediately addresses whatever the problem you are having is? How many times? I got my 90-day chip. I walk into a meeting. There's a dude I've never seen before, never seen since. And I'm thinking, I'm like, well, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Now what do I do? This dude from Atlanta just starts sharing. And he's like, "Well, you know, I was talking to my sponsor back when I was new. And he said, I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. Now what?" And he said, "Oh, you go to 90 and 90 more." And it's like, wisdom from, right? I mean, how many times? right? Because, I mean, that's what I'm concerned with. I care so little about people's concept of a higher power. What matters to me is whether or not they're connected to it, right? Whether or not you got juice. And you can see it in people. You can tell when somebody gets the lights turned on for them. Because everything's different now. And those things that they wouldn't do, they're like, yeah, let's do it. Oh, we're going to help at some halfway house? Awesome. Right? And I started making amends, and I got to make amends to my grandparents, and I would suggest getting a spiritual advisor. I would say, from my experience, getting a spiritual advisor is very helpful. It doesn't even necessarily have to be in a religion, just somebody you believe practices spiritual principles really well. And if I hadn't made amends to my grandmother, I wouldn't have had one. And I went to my grandmother and I told her I'd neglected her and I hadn't been a good grandson, not a good member of the family, you know, the deal. And I asked her what she wanted, and she just wanted to see me more. And so I started taking her lunch on Sundays, talking to my grandmother and learning about her, asking her questions. Right? And I found, I mean, my parents are the same way. It's the women in my family that are the best in practice of spiritual principles. They just do it. And I get to learn from my mom, and I got to learn from my grandmother. And, you know, I learned that in the 60s, she would wake up with burning crosses on her lawn. You know, because they were in 60s Alabama, and they, you know, were against segregation. They were threatened. They had to ride in different parts of the train with their friends. And they did the right thing, even though it was hard. Right? That's what I've learned about my family in making amends, is that they seem to naturally be able to do the right thing, even when it's hard. This past weekend, I had to write. I'm back in school. They let me into a school. And I had to take this writing test. And the prompt on the test was, tell about a time where you saw something wrong that was happening, how you felt, and what you did. And what I wrote about was when a friend of mine in grade school was getting bullied. Probably the best friend I had. And I didn't help him. I joined in. Because I was afraid. And he forgave me that day. People around me do a way better job than I do. So I get to know my grandmother by taking her lunch every day. And I find out who she really is. And she starts showing me how to behave. And teaching me the kind of stuff I probably should have been paying attention to the whole time. You know, and I remember this one time. So my granddad, well, I should probably tell that first. So the big book does not say we make amends to people if they will remember it. My granddad was late stage Alzheimer's and dementia, and he knew that I was related to him, but he wasn't like quite sure how. We all have the same face. And so when I would come in, he would say, oh, it's the bearded one. So I came in and I went to him and I said, Grandpa, you know, I've been living selfishly and I haven't been a good member of this family. I've neglected you. I haven't been there. And I'm trying to do things different now. He was a minister. And so I'm trying to do God's will, I think. Because it says we can stress that if we know they won't be offended by it. Right. And he didn't know my name. But what he asked me was this. How did you feel when you were behaving selfishly? Thought about it, and I was like, pretty bad most of the time. So how do you feel now that you're trying to do what you think God wants you to do? Thought about it, I was like, I feel pretty good most of the time. And he said, that means you're forgiven. And I needed it. I had spent years arguing with people about why their God didn't exist. I needed to be told that I'd already been forgiven. That it had already happened. That I didn't have anything to sweat, right? It should have been apparent. I'd already had the obsession to drink removed. But I needed him to tell me that. And he didn't know my name, but he knew to tell me that. Because he's hooked up. right? He's got access to power. He knows the things he's supposed to do. Yeah, it's just crazy how much we have to do just to get enough power to do the stuff we ought to be doing anyway. You know? Oh. So I got to reestablish these relationships, and my grandfather didn't live for very long after that, and he had passed, and I was taking my grandmother to this family function, and actually it's funny, I'll tell you about my arrogance first. A friend of ours, Milan, many people in here remember him, had died, and I did me a whole mess of inventory on it, you know, and I found out how I was angry at God, taking my friend away, right, all this stuff. And I know my granddad's not doing good, right? And I know it's coming. And I, in my arrogance, I think I have done enough work to be prepared, right? And so I find out my granddad passed, and I'm at work. My dad's like, I'm coming to get you. And it was about an hour away, and I'm just sitting there. I don't feel nothing. Right? I'm like, yeah, I did it. I truly thought that I was able to not because I did a good job. And I saw my dad crying, and something broke, and I started to cry, and it physically hurt. And for the first time in a long time, I thought, man, I'd love a drink, right? And I only do the stuff that y'all tell me works for you, and y'all say prayer works. So I asked my dad if he wanted to pray, and we prayed, and the thought passed. And I went and I said one of the most sincere prayers I've ever said. I said, God, I'll do whatever you want. Just please give me enough power to go through this and be helpful to somebody else. And I went in the room where his body was. He wasn't there. And my grandma was just in there crying, just sitting there crying. I'm like, do you want to be here? She said, no. So we left. And I got to help with the business of death. Right? You have to do things to get somebody buried. And I was able to do that for my grandmother, which really probably any normal person could just do. But I needed to have power to be able to do it, to be able to show up and do the things that are right. You know? I have gotten to sponsor some of the most awesome dudes in sobriety. Like, I've now sponsored two guys who've lost at least one parent. One of them's lost both. And in sobriety, and I've watched them walk through it, and I'm just amazed. You know, so this one guy, he's getting his master's at WVU. We've lived a bunch of places, but this is when we lived in West Virginia. And he's getting his master's there, and his dad gets real sick. And he drops everything that he's doing. And he moves in with his dad, and he walks him the whole way. Takes care of him for months, right? And we had been in contact. We were talking, you know, I'd see him every couple weeks. I'd go up and see him. He'd call me, right? And his dad did pass. And I hadn't heard from him in a couple days. And I got worried, right? We get worried if you don't hear from somebody in a couple days sometimes. And I got worried. And I'm just sitting in French class. And I'm like, hey, man, I haven't heard from you in a little while. I was like, you doing all right? Not thinking about getting messed up, are you? Because he immediately texted back, ha ha, that's stupid. I've got God. And I was like, oh, right. I remember what we were doing now. Right? He had power. Right? I get to do stuff today that was absolutely impossible for me. I didn't tell y'all, but my grade point average from the first university that I went to school at, when I went back to school, I got to find out that it was 0.4. Which means at any given time, my blood alcohol content was higher than my grade point average. Normal people pass out at like 0.35. Not us. Not us. Right? And I've gotten to go back to school and I've gotten to rectify that mistake. And I actually have like a 3.2 now. And the thing that's important about that is, I didn't start doing well in class until I got over a fear, right? I didn't even start going until I got over a fear. And the fear was, you know what? I'm not going to be as smart as I think I am. Here's the thing about that. I'm not as smart as I think I am. I'm not. I thought I'd be able to just go. I'm going to take a little test, get me some good grades. That's not how it works. I have to do the things that students do. You know, go to class, take notes, do your homework, go to study groups, right? Like, I have to do those things. And the real turnaround for me was when I would go and park my car 20 minutes before class and sit in my car and say, God, please make me useful to my fellow students. Please show me some way that I can be helpful. And then it was easy. I didn't even have to really try. I just do the stuff that I said I would do to these other people, and it wasn't hard anymore. You know? I had to go back to school. One day I'll finish. I don't know. You know, when I got sober, I thought if you had asked me to make a list of the things that I need to be happy, right, I would have told you I need a job at a higher pay rate. I need my driver's license back. I need a new car because I wrapped it around the tree. I need a girlfriend. I need to I need to be able to leave the county. Those kind of things, right? 10 months sober, I had just done this for the first time where I just get up and bleh at y'all. And I got down from doing this and I realized none of those things had changed. Everything was exactly the same. Same job at the same pay rate with no girlfriend at my parents' house, can't leave the county, on probation, right? Everything's the same. But I was happy. You know? And that's just magic. Right? Because I had fallen victim to the lie that I think most human beings fall victim to. If I get the right stuff at the right time with the right people, I'll be happy. Anybody else ever gotten the right stuff at the right time with the right people and been sad? I tried to arrange life to suit myself, and the results were awful. And so really all I have to do now is I have to try and do God's will, which I know very little about. I mean, I've been here 12 years. I'll tell you what I've surmised. Okay? One, I believe that God wants me to live a principled life where I try to do the right thing even if it's hard. I believe that about God. And the second thing I believe about God's will is that He wants me to help somebody else. Right? I've told you everything that I know about God's will. I function under a few other assumptions, but those are the things that I believe are absolutely true. And it doesn't seem to matter what our concept of God is. It really doesn't seem to matter, because I know people from all over the world who've gotten sober with all different kinds of religions or no religions. Concept doesn't seem to matter. Conception doesn't seem to matter, but connection seems to be extremely important. You know? I get to have all those things that I thought I needed to be happy. I got a house. I got another house that one day maybe we'll be able to sell. I was able to pay for a car. They let me drive motor vehicles. I'm married to an awesome person who works a way better program than I do. Right? Like, all these things were impossible for me. And they've happened. Right? And I think there's something, I'm going to butcher it and it's going to be awesome. The long form of the 11th tradition talks about how anonymity is necessary so that we can be humble enough so that our great blessings may never spoil us. I think it's one of the most intense things anybody's written in on any of our literature, right? Is that to just do work, right? Chop wood and carry water. Right? And don't expect anything for it. Right? Is the way that we keep from our blessings spoiling us. Because I don't deserve anything that I have. I truly do not. I was awful for well over a decade. Well over two decades. I was 26. I was a crappy kid too. Right? I was not a contributing member of society. And I've gotten far, far more than I deserve. I didn't do anything virtuous the last night I drank. I was the same drunken jerk I'd been a million times before. The only thing that was different was I was broken enough to start listening to what y'all had to tell me. Where's the virtue in that? Just being broken. That's all I brought to the table here. That's all I needed to bring to the table. So when I was ready to let y'all tell me what to do, y'all told me exactly what to do. And it's math. When I did what y'all told me to do, I got the results that y'all get. And I know it's true because I'm looking around and I'm seeing people who were here when I got sober. I see a whole mess of them. I see people pushing 20, 30 years, right? In a row. Nights and weekends, holidays, all that, right? And I'm the guy that I couldn't stay sober for 9 days, you know? I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to be sober. I should have thanked a million people, but I didn't. My mind went blank like 5 minutes ago, so I probably should have stopped then. But I love y'all, and I'm really grateful to be here, and I'll pass.